Hi, I'm Ryan Hanley of the Department of Political Science at Boston College. I'm extremely honored to be guest hosting this episode of the Political Theory Review, a podcast and conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking with a scholar very well known to the audience of this podcast. Jeffrey Church is professor of political science at the University of Houston. In addition to being the host of this podcast, he's also the author, most recently, of Kant, Liberalism, and the Meaning of Life, published by Oxford in 2022. Church is a political theorist with particular interests in the history of early modern political thought, and the author of numerous articles as well as two previous books, Infinite Autonomy, The Divided Individual in Hegel and Nietzsche's Political Philosophy, in 2012, and Nietzsche's Culture of Humanity, Beyond Aristocracy and Democracy in the Early Period. This is Cambridge 2015. Jeff Church, what a pleasure it is to say to you, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Why, thank you for having me here, Ryan. Welcome back to you, too. Been on here, this is your fifth time?
Yeah, for the thumb, as they say, right? Yeah. It's a pleasure to be back, and it's fun to be on this side of the microphone. This is really, really a treat, and I'm really honored, and I'll try to do justice to this fine podcast, as well as do justice to this fine book. Congratulations on a really fine piece of work. I know you've been working on this for a while, I've been looking forward to it for a while, and I'm really glad to see it come to fruition, especially at the very high quality that it is. So I've been looking forward to this discussion for a long time, and I thought we might just open with some of the most basic elements of the book, not least of which are the categories of its title. So it's very nicely broken up. Kant, Liberalism, and the Meaning of Life. And so I thought, for starters, we might start by just talking a bit about the first of these, which is Kant. Why Kant? In particular, why Kant for you? I think of you first and foremost. You do a lot of things, but by your books, you're a Nietzsche guy. Kant is not Nietzsche, though maybe we'll return to that a little bit more in our discussion. Tell me, what motivated you to turn to Kant for this particular project?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for reading the book. And preparing all the questions that you did. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Why Kant? Yeah, well, Kant, as I began to read and develop my interpretation of Nietzsche, it became increasingly clear to me that Nietzsche is a kind of Kantian, which I know is, you know, not the universally shared view about Nietzsche and is controversial in the literature, but in general, I found one of the central concepts motivating Nietzsche's own project to be one that Kant initiated, and I think before him, Rousseau, which is a project to understand and rehabilitate the modern notion of freedom. And so I began, as you said, in my career with reading Nietzsche and with a scholarship on Nietzsche, and tried to get at the heart of what actually is animating Nietzsche's project. And I eventually came to think that I need to kind of get back to some of Nietzsche's intellectual forebears in order to fully appreciate the nature of the project and what he himself was responding to. So this is why I ultimately went back to Kant. The original iteration of this book actually went back even further and had a chapter on Rousseau. But I was advised, when the book swelled to such a length, which is not surprising for a book on the meaning of life, let's narrow the scope just simply to Kant. But I mean, that's generally the intellectual trajectory that I went, was to sort of go back, I think, to try to wrestle with this originary figure for all the philosophers that came after him. I think he just plays such an enormous role in cast such a shadow that it's important to appreciate what Kant is after.
Great, and I hope that we can return to this question of the relationship between Kant and Nietzsche. It's obviously, to describe Nietzsche as Kantian is really a fascinating thing that I'm sure will pique some members of the audience. But we should also talk about the other direction, too. I'm going to save that, though, for a little bit. especially since you mentioned, as you were writing this book, how it could grow given the enormity of one of the other categories in its title, which is the concept of the meaning of life. And so I wonder if you might say a few words about that at the outset. And clearly, this is a very familiar colloquial term today. It sort of rolls off the tongue when you think about philosophy 101 questions or the stereotyped vision of those. But of course, this could mean a lot of different things. It could mean, could it connote metaphysical questions about our place in the cosmos, ethical questions about our purpose specifically in life. And you allude to some of these different meanings, but perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about what you mean by the meaning of life here, and also why you refer to it in the singular in terms of the meaning of life.
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly popular in philosophy scholarship to talk about meanings of life for obvious reasons to sort of capture some of the pluralism of it. I mean, I wanted to buck that trend in part because I think that Kant is one of these figures who insists on a singular meaning of life. And so I'm sort of following him and interpreting him in that sense. I mean, what do I mean when referring to that? I mean, in part, this is a project that aims to be one of the few reconstructions of what Kant himself meant by the meaning of life. So there's been little scholarship in the voluminous scholarship on Kant on his actual accounts of the meaning of life. There are a couple articles here and there that take it on, though they focus on Kant's moral philosophy in large part. And for those who know Kant and Kant's moral philosophy, this should come as no surprise that he thinks of kind of our moral vocation as central to our meaning of life. But part of what I wanted to do also is sort of get a more expansive or broader appreciation of Kant's really big understanding of the meaning of life, which I think begins to emerge earlier than Kant's, the development of his moral philosophy in the 1780s. It starts to develop in reaction to his response with Rousseau. And when Kant begins to lecture and develop his account of human nature and his lectures on anthropology in the 1760s and 1770s, he really begins to try to get an account of the meaning of life, or Kant's term is the Bestimmung des Menschen, the vocation of humanity, what our overall purpose in the cosmos is, based on an understanding or appreciation of what our natural telos is, the telos of our human nature. And so I'm really taking my bearings and thinking about the meaning of life from Kant and how he, I think, begins a modern tradition of thinking about this phrase that he himself didn't use, but I think he sort of began to create a category for. The terms like purpose or value of life predated Kant, but when you look into the history of the phrase meaning of life, this is something that doesn't emerge until the 19th century, and so it's a kind of phrase that I think Kant gives rise to.
Yeah, great. And you mentioned in your answer that, of course, one of the ways in which these questions have typically been raised through Kant scholarship is a focus on its moral philosophy. And by implication, one of the things that you're doing here that makes the book very unique is this is really a book on Kant's political philosophy proper. And so I want to use that to motivate, just by way of, at the outset here, of just briefly commenting on the third of the three categories, which is of course, liberalism. And maybe you can say a little bit how you understand this book. You frame the book in the introduction as a response to this remarkable moment that we're living through with these remarkable strident critiques on both left and right of the liberal project. Maybe you could say a little bit more about how you understand Kant's role in this particular story and what exactly Kant can do to help us move through this particular impasse.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you might think that my own personal and political motivation for writing this book, which was the Well, really, I think it was born around the 2016 election when, you know, all of us were awaiting the election returns and watching the New York Times prediction needle move from all the way from Hillary Clinton over to Donald Trump.
I was sitting in Wisconsin and watching the television, in a state of shock and awe, I think is the way to put it.
And I remember having a conversation with a graduate student that night when seeing how much closer, before it was clear that Trump was the winner, but how much closer it was than commentators were expecting. And I remember discussing this question about a sense of meaning and purpose in liberalism. That is that at that time in 2016, there were already some distinct challenges to, you could say, the sort of health of liberalism writ large. That this was a time where you had citizens from Britain who were peeling off to join ISIS, for example. So there were clear ways in which it seemed like the liberal tradition was beginning to crack, that there was an appeal both from the left and the right that seemed to offer more of a greater sense of meaning and purpose, and the center seemed to be kind of beleaguered. I mean, it's represented in part by Hillary Clinton, and that just didn't arouse voters' sense of a strong meaning and purpose in life. And so that's kind of what originally sort of motivated thinking about this project. So what is it about liberalism that's that led to this particular state, and how is it that we can think of liberalism more broadly, rejuvenate it, to add to it once again a greater sense of sort of a fighting creed for liberalism that can arouse citizens or members of a liberal society more of a sense that of belonging and purpose. And so that's the opening frame of the introduction, is thinking about this moment and thinking about how in the 20th century liberalism has tended in a direction to abstract from questions about the good life. And so that led me to Rawls as, I think, the preeminent figure in modern political philosophy who attempts to develop a defense of liberalism. And he does it from a neo-Kantian perspective, but in my view develops liberalism precisely in the sorts of ways that can't solve the sorts of problems that I encountered in that fateful day in 2016. Rawls's liberalism aims precisely to abstract from questions about the good life and focus instead on questions of justice, to remain neutral about questions of the good life and instead just focus on questions of the right. This might have been appropriate for a different kind of age, and indeed it was. I mean, Rawls's a lot of his project was born during questions about divisions between secular and religious approaches to liberalism, which something like a bracketing approach to liberalism is appropriate. But I think in our contemporary age, which is an age of great polarization, the hollowing out of the center, what's most needful is a liberalism that augments and it invigorates a sense of common purpose. And so with the difficulties in Rawls, I found the route back to Kant, because Kant, of course, is, was Rawls's inspiration, so he became mine as well. I found Kant to be he's one of the great liberals, of course, but I also found him to be his corpus to be much more expansive in offering lots of other opportunities for thinking through some of these problems that I've faced in liberalism. And so that led me back to Kant's earlier work. Much of the work that has inspired the neo-Kantians like Rawls was Kant's later so-called critical period work. That is the projects that were published after the Critique of Pure Reason in 1781. I was led then instead to the project that gave birth to the Critique of Pure Reason, which is the works that he wrote prior to it, and which, in my view, I think motivated a lot of the critical project, which was his anthropology, his views of human nature that he developed in the 1760s and 1770s. So that's really what I think, you know, long-winded way of bringing us from liberalism and the crisis of liberalism back to Kant.
That's great. That's very helpful here. And I especially like the way that you set it up, both in your answer right then and also in the book, in terms of a, should we say, sort of a liberal alternative to Rawlsian value neutrality and Rawlsian procedural liberalism. But I wonder, you know, let me play a little bit of devil's advocate here and just try and push you a little, which is, I mean, in your answer just now, you motivate the turn to Kant's liberalism with meaning as an antidote to some of the things that are happening in our age, among them, enemy, polarization. Mm-hmm. But couldn't the case be made, and here I'm going to just try and be Rawls's lawyer, if you need one,
yeah.
Couldn't the case be made that it's precisely at a time of rampant polarization that we most need a procedural liberalism that focuses on an overlapping consensus where we can find it in bringing down the tone of politics and not fighting about all of the sort of the incommensurate ends? What would you say to a Rawlsian liberal who says it's precisely our moment that demonstrates the need for Rawlsian-style liberalism rather than further debates over value?
Yeah. I mean, I think that my answer, it's similar to an answer that Michael Sandel has long given, which is I think we tried that approach for much of the 20th century, right? That is, the so-called the development in neoliberalism in the 20th century, which was precisely to sort of attempt to bracket questions of morality and religion and focus on economic and technocratic approaches to liberalism, that I think was ultimately unsuccessful. I mean, precisely because, and here I'm, you know, this is not me only, but figures like Michael Sandel would argue that it's precisely because of such bracketing of some of these higher questions that citizens in liberal democracies kind of hungered for more meaning, for a sense of common purpose, and they found that outlet instead of through liberalism or common liberal project, they found that outlet instead in forms of populism on the left and the right. And so I'm skeptical that any kind of approach now that would seek to kind of double down on that approach could be successful.
I almost feel like this is the time to rewrite Horace. And instead of, you can cast nature out with a pitchfork, but it will always come back. You can cast value out with a pitchfork, but it will always come back. And I think you're right to say that this is sort of coming back with a vengeance. And that's a really powerful way, then, I think, of motivating, as you've done, our turn to Kant and the possibility of, as I put it, a liberalism with meaning. But as you put it, and we'll talk more about this, I hope, perfectionist liberalism. Let's push a little further, though, and then talk about how you present Kant's ideas of where meaning comes from. Mm-hmm. Because this, I found to be one of the most interesting parts of the book, which is that throughout the book, you come back at several places to the idea that meaning is something that is, quote-unquote, created. And it's something that you raise several times. Nature doesn't give us meaning in particular. It's something that we have to create. Tell me a little bit more about what that means, though, especially vis-a-vis Kant. I mean, I you don't want to say, I take it, that Kant thinks that we are meaning creators in the same way that Nietzsche thinks that we're value creators. Or maybe you do want to say that. Tell me what you mean, especially then, with regard to meaning creation in Kant's view.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too far away from Nietzsche, actually, at the end of the day, although, again, this is my idiosyncratic view of Nietzsche, but we could get into that, you know, in part because I don't think that value creation in Nietzsche is something that can be that can happen sort of arbitrarily or willy-nilly. I think a similar project is going on in Kant, so let me just sort of sketch out how I understand it. I think, you know, the most useful way to think about Kant's view of meaning and the development of it is by contrast to, you could say, an ancient conception of the purpose of human existence, right? So this is just, again, speaking in very broad and kind of crude terms, but you might think of like an ancient view of our telos, say in somebody like Aristotle, and there's some debate in Aristotle exactly what our highest end is, but the general picture in somebody like Aristotle is that every human species, every species on Earth has a certain kind of end or purpose, right? And so sometimes Aristotle's examples are things like trees. They start out as a seed, and implicit in them is a big tree that it's eventually going to develop into. So too for human beings, that we have a kind of telos, and that telos guides our end towards some kind of single purpose. Now Kant has quite a different view of our purpose. He's in broadly in the Aristotelian tradition of thinking that nature and the natural things within it have purposes. But when it comes to human beings are a little bit different in that human beings, and this he draws on most decisively, I think, Rousseau. He argues that human beings have two Bestimmungen, as he calls it, two vocations, two ends, two teloi, you might say, that Kant thinks that are in conflict with one another. So if the Aristotelian or ancient view is that human beings have a single telos that can be, that can have some kind of rank order or hierarchical organization, for Kant, human nature is actually kind of tragically divided. That nature gives us two different kinds of ends. One end is, and these are my terms, not Kant's, but one end is that of what you could call wholeness. That is, we strive to unify with other human beings, form communities in the forms of loving partnerships, friendships, law governed organizations, and so forth, so as to achieve a kind of order and concord with the human beings. The other is what I call perfection, right? That is the development of all of our inherent human capacities, cognitive and emotional, to their highest extent. And the reason why these two ends Kant thinks are in conflict with one another is that our end of perfection tends to question all those very norms and orders that constitute our and make up the orders that satisfy our desire for wholeness, right? So our desire for perfection drives us to ask questions about mom and dad. You know, mom and dad give us this familial order, but my drive for perfection is going to ask, mom and dad, is that really the right kind of rule that should govern my life? And so human perfection ends up coming at the expense of our, comes in tension with our form of wholeness. So there's a way of putting, I think, human nature in those kind of stark terms. I think that this draws in part on Rousseau, which you can see in Kant's early anthropology, when Kant develops a kind of genealogical history of humanity's development, much like you see in Rousseau's Second Discourse, in which Kant, like Rousseau, sees in human nature an originary form of wholeness, a form of kind of natural man, which exists in harmony with the rest of nature, but then a development of human freedom that breaks us from that kind of originary wholeness, and that drives us into a kind of competitive struggle with other human beings for a kind of form of status. And that drive for competition and status itself leads to a sort of higher and higher forms of perfection and development on the part of human facilities. Those people who are listening to this, probably most familiar place that you can find this in Kant's more familiar works is in his Idea for Universal History with a Cosmopolitan End. He has a very sort of famous account of unsociable sociability as the sort of characteristic tension that exists in human nature. It's that sociability that I'm talking about in terms of the desire for wholeness and the unsociability that drives us apart from one another and drives us to the development of the arts and sciences and creates all sorts of misery and discontent. So that's the kind of condition that Kant thinks that nature puts us in, right? Unlike Aristotle, where nature gives us a kind of harmonious end or purpose, for Kant, nature is dissatisfying or irrational in a deep sort of way because it divides us against one another.
Yeah. This is fascinating. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of the book, Kant's views on nature. And it was very helpful hearing you now restate, and you do a really great job with this in the book, restate some of his differences with the ancients, even though he's a form of teleologist. But on this question of nature in particular, there's real differences with the ancients, and I wonder how far even we want to go with these. I was struck by, say, I just heard in your previous answer, you mentioned one of the chapter titles, chapter 4, on Kant's genealogy of morality. And that was one of the moments where the Nietzscheanism is poking through. Yeah. But it was chapter 3 that I was actually most struck by just in terms of title, where you describe, I think it's called the natural worthlessness of life. And that's really strong. That's not just that nature is unavailable as a source of value in a certain way, or there's a telos out there that we need to apprehend but can't. But the fact that it's, in fact, worthless until human agency constructs value. And I think I'm restating the argument, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, because I wonder then, in tacking away from an older ancient idea of nature or an early modern idea of natural law, I wonder how far, I was wondering how far Kant is going in this other direction. Is it possible that if all... I'm looking at one of the places where you describe that the task being to, quote, construct an artificial world of value independent of nature, end quote. Tell me if, I mean, I've just taken that out of context, but it could be something like the high road to nihilism. Say a few more words here about why you think that that's not the particular worry here and why we shouldn't be worried about that, and instead that this is a productive route towards creating a healthy sense of value.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and so, right, the view is not that, you know, nature is worthless and we should chuck it, right, and just sort of construct whatever values we want ex nihilo. Yeah, that would be a kind of vulgar Nietzscheanism that, again, I don't see in Nietzsche, but instead, the worry and what motivates the worthlessness is the fact that the fact of nature's irrationality, right? Precisely in the kind of conflict that nature presents before us, right? Such that if we were to live a natural existence, and the kinds of lives that Kant identifies as lives that try to follow our natural ends are, on the one hand, happiness, which is the end that most fully seeks to live in accordance with our telos for wholeness, or contemplation, which is the end or form of life that most fully seeks to live in accordance with our human perfection, that both of those lives are deeply dissatisfying to human beings for a variety of reasons. And that the most important reason is that they themselves don't fulfill the fullness of our nature, and in fact manifest that division within our souls that leads to such the kind of dissatisfaction that we're more familiar with, say, in from Rousseau's Second Discourse that I think Kant develops here further. And so, you know, it's not that nature itself as a whole across the board is worthless, but it's just in the case of human beings that there's a kind of tension or conflict that raises a question about its worth, and then motivates human beings to set out to solve the problem that they see in nature, right?
Yeah, that's. I like your formulation very much of how nature is irrational. Something needs to be done with nature to make it amenable to our rational capacities. But now it occurs to me to follow up with that then just by asking, I love the idea, and we're going to have to talk about this because you do a fantastic job of treating a number of very difficult concepts in Kant's political philosophy, including right and freedom, among many others. But one that I'm now, it occurs to me, is that dignity is not a prominent concept here. And I wonder if, well, I'll just ask it in this simple way. Why not? This would be dignity insofar as it's a place where it seems to be both, at once part of our inherent being, in Kant's view, but also something that exists because of our rational capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, because I think our dignity comes as a result of, emerges, I guess you could say, as a result of our realization of the sort of tragic position that nature thrusts us into. Our dignity emerges precisely from the fact that we can recognize this tragedy as a tragedy, right? Mm. If you can recognize a tragedy as a tragedy, it in a sense puts you above the tragedy, right? And assess it as a tragedy and can envision potentially something better, some kind of resolution to it. And so, I mean, this is the sort of way in which I'm treating Kant in a way that's very unfamiliar to folks, because typically I think the way that folks read Kant, which is, you know, I think maybe what motivates your question, is that, you know, you open up the groundwork and there's this discussion about rational agency and the dignity of human beings. In my view, that's the sort of end point of a natural development in human beings, that the story is doesn't begin there, but it begins with a kind of anthropological development to that point. That's a kind of, as it were, a sort of end of history acknowledgement or recognition of our human dignity. That dignity comes at the end of a long struggle of human beings to realize our freedom and realize our potential.
Yeah, I think one of the great strengths of the book is the degree to which you show that so many seeds of the critical philosophy were planted in the pre-critical period, and especially in the 1760s and then through the anthropology lectures of the 1770s. That was really eye-opening to me as somebody that's tried to spend some time with the early writings of the 1760s. With that in mind, let's go say we've been talking a little bit about Nietzsche, but you've also mentioned Rousseau. You even mentioned at the outset, it was fascinating to hear that Rousseau was even going to be an explicit part of this project with a chapter. And I can see what that chapter, I think, would have looked like, because he's such an important interlocutor for both Kant and for you. And so I wonder if you might say a few more words about really where the fault lines are between Kant and Rousseau on this question. Because the way you frame it in the book is that Kant inherits a problem from Rousseau, specifically with regard to the multiple ends of our nature. On the one hand, our desire for self-perfection, on the other hand, our desire to contribute to the well-being of humanity and the wholeness that that brings from being in a community. And I hope you'll tell me if I mm-hmm. have misstated the claims. How then, and so if that's the question that they share, it seems that Kant's answer is quite different from Rousseau's. Mm. And, of course, you're interested in the question they share and the answer that Kant gives. But I wonder if I could just encourage you to think out loud a little bit and maybe say a few words about how Rousseau's response to this common problem may or may not differ from Kant's response.
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult issue, I think, in reading Rousseau, in part because it's not always clear, ultimately, at the end of the day, what Rousseau's position is.
What keeps Rousseau scholars like us in business.
I should really just ask you this question, but here's the stab. I mean, I tend to be on the side of those Rousseau readers who think of him as an honorary German. Not everybody does, you have a paper, Ryan, on Rousseau's Moral Letters, which was a part of my reading in this lost chapter here. Well, I published the chapter in Constellations, but a part of this chapter on Rousseau's view of conscience, and how Rousseau's view of conscience ultimately at bottom is the source of our, well, you said it a minute ago, the source of our dignity and value, and the and a kind of answer to the kind of tensions, similar tensions that that I was just describing in Kant between our desire for kind of originary wholeness and a longing for perfection, that the conscience in some way kind of holds those two things together. I think what divides Rousseau from Kant, though, is precisely, and I think you were suggesting this, in the kind of answer that they give. Rousseau, it's not clear to me, finally gives a kind of a final integrative account of how that sort of tragic two-sidedness of our nature can finally be reconciled, right? I mean, he gives, you know, like the social contract, which I think is one version of this, where, you know, political legislation is a form that sort of can regulate and harmonize our desire for perfection and wholeness. But he also kind of appeals to the solitary walker or the solitary individual. So Kant, you know, is very different and offers a much more optimistic take on how it is that these two ends can be brought together. And that's ultimately through the moral project, which is to think about, rather than taking the political route, which Rousseau does, Kant takes a moral, universalist, cosmopolitan route to thinking about how it is that humanity at large can find a form of universal emancipation, not just politically, but sort of universally. And it's through that kind of moral project, the project of universal emancipation, where we finally fulfill our moral vocation and a kingdom of ends, which would encompass all of humanity. That it's in that condition then that sort of the striving for our perfection, the arts and sciences, for example, and our desire for wholeness, kind of general unity with other individuals, can be unified. I'm not sure that Rousseau has quite as rosy of a picture ultimately, that these natural human ends can finally be integrated in that kind of human construction of a kingdom of ends.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I mean, and as you know, a number of Rousseau scholars, Todorov is the best, I think, short introduction to this particular formulation of the issue. But the idea that there are, he just gives us multiple normative ideals in terms of how do we move forward with the question. Well, on the one hand, it's a meal, natural man and society. On the other hand, it's the fully artificial citizen of this social contract. On the if we have a third hand, we've got whatever the Jean-Jacques of the reveries and the other autobiographical writings is. And so these are difficult ones to put together and try and figure out how they mesh. And it's, I take it partially Rousseau's reflection of the intractability of the problem to recognize that there might not be a final solution, or a single final solution. But, you know, of those options, the one that's most Kantian, I think, is certainly the citizen of the social contract. And one of the things that's striking in your book, and really helpfully developed, is the degree to which, if we're to find meaning in modern life, in Kant's terms, it's not going to be simply moral, or it's not the ethical agency of an autonomous agent. It specifically has to be political, and political in a very particular way. I found this to be a really helpful part of the book, and I wonder if you could say a little bit more why life in community and civilization is so necessary for the full realization of meaning for the modern agent.
Yeah, right. That's good. I mean, in short, the reason is that political society, unlike moral community, its aim is to harmonize the totality of our nature, right? So moral community is that community that seeks to realize that the highest aims of our aspirations of our freedom, such that we become kind of unified through a form of through that kingdom of ends in which everyone treats everyone else as an end and end in itself, not simply as a means. Whereas politics is quite different in the sense that it's always on the way towards that final end. It's a recognition of our embodied character, right? So politics starts with the assertion of the law, right? With the idea that one needs coercion. Human beings need coercion precisely because we are unsociable to one another. We have different ends. We're largely motivated by self-love, and we come into conflict with one another, and we require law to punish us and keep us in order. But politics is also, at the same time, aspirational in the sense that it's a community in which we do things together, and that reflect and embody and partially constitute our freedom specifically in those kinds of political communities that are liberal and Republican. That is, those kinds of communities in which the members of those societies create the kinds of laws that govern them, right? So in those kinds of societies, let's just call them, you know, liberal societies for short, those are the kinds of societies in which, you know, some part of our highest aspiration for autonomy can be realized, that we can create the kinds of laws that govern us. So it's politics sort of marries both sort of sides of it seeks to bring together that conflict that I spoke earlier about in our human nature, and precisely by giving us a route towards a kind of higher reconciliation of those of that nature in an aspiration towards the freedom of that society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really it's fascinating that this is the route that Kant takes. We all know the famous stories, or Kant scholars will know the famous stories about his encounter with Emile the day it came in the post, and he interrupted his daily walk that one time because he was so engrossed with it. But it's so striking that he really takes, I mean, Emile is not political, whatever else one would say of him. And the realization of this life that will provide meaning can't happen with Emile's education if he's meant to live the life that that he does. And it's very just striking to me to see, for all their agreement, that there is a deeply political turn in Kant that raises the question of to what degree our politics today can be reformed in such a way that people will have that agency again, right? Every undergraduate student, when they read the social contract, can see that he's getting after agency in social contract 1.6 and participating in the general will. But how does that translate into real politics?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could say a few words about the sorts of things that would need to be done today for our politics again to be a politics in which people not just found meaning, but had agency and participation.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, let me get it in this way, which is that in the meat of the chapters on Kant's politics, I tend to approach Kant's politics in a different sort of way than usual in the scholarship, which is the scholarship tends to focus on, you know, sort of in a way that Rawls does, which is, you know, what are the a priori rules of right that govern and should govern a political society, a sort of natural law approach to politics. My understanding approach to Rousseau, and this is part comes from his anthropology, is a much more rough and tumble, you could say, dynamic conception of how Kant thinks about political societies. That is, that politics is much more, for Kant, expansive in how we should think about it than simply in the kind of deontological, a priori, legalistic approach of someone like Rawls. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is, and I developed this out in the book, that Kant really thinks that there are three different kinds of communities that human beings develop in order to realize the different ends that I've spoken about thus far. So human beings develop what he calls culture, cultura, in order to realize and satisfy our desire for perfection. Kant says what culture does is it's a community or partnership for the fostering of human skill, which is skill is the capacity or for human beings to do whatever we want to fulfill any of our aims, and that's our human perfection. And so Kant, you know, the more familiar examples here are the sort of development of the arts and sciences, that and technology, that the modern age. The other form of community is what he calls civilization. Civilization being that form of community that realizes our wholeness, and the civilization encompasses those norms of order that bring a kind of concord and harmony to human existence. So it begins with a law, but also extends to norms of politeness and that of honor. And so those forms of community aim to satisfy both our nature. They come into conflict, and we can talk about that if you want. But there's also a third form of community, a kind of moral community that seeks to satisfy our higher striving for freedom. And that he sees in the properly political society that I was speaking of before. So I lay this out all in part to answer your question, which is to say that one of the ways that I think Kant can think about politics and participating in politics is not simply through the political process per se, but that there are multiple forms of community in modern liberal societies that members of liberal societies can engage with and find meaning in, right? So one can become a part of culture and seek to engage and enhance culture, engage and enhance the project of the arts and sciences and advance them in the modern age, and see as a result of that a kind of ennobling or advancement of our nature broadly understood. One can be a part of civilization and advance the rules of the norms of civilization and find some kind of meaning. So I think, you know, his picture is not like Rousseau in this way of a kind of, you know, deliberative assembly that one needs to be a part of. It's much more of a sense, although there is the importance of citizenship, but also a much more pluralistic sense that civil society can also encompass and incorporate a lot of different kind of strivings that can arouse our sense of meaning.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Actually, and it's very helpful as I sort of think about how rich Kant's understanding of civilization in this particular respect is, which is, on the one hand, there is the idea that it provides us with a sphere in which we can participate, deliberate, be in concord with others, and have some agency in the creation of laws within our community. But in many ways, the more interesting side is less the one of concord than of discord. Hmm. And I think you bring this out very nicely, and it's one of the points that connects your treatment of the early anthropology to the later lecture, or the later shorter writings, and especially the idea for universal history. This idea of how agonistic society is, and how that agonism is what makes perfection and the pursuit of perfection possible. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I mean, are we right to think of Kant's, I mean, so far from being a procedural liberal, one who actually sees the benefits of a certain type of discord, or maybe we should just say competition in civil society?
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, again, those readers who are familiar with the idea for universal history will see this immediately, right? That's, this is what he says. If all we had was our desire for wholeness and concord, we would be no different than those, you know, like Arcadian shepherds. he says our existence would have no meaning. Then we would be no different than the animals in the pasture. And so it's precisely our the competition and strife that allows us to emerge out of that animalistic state of nature, Rousseauan state of nature, and achieve higher states of the soul. And this is what I'm going maybe even farther than that sketch and the idea for universal history, which is that it's precisely out of that then tension between that, because we have a competitive struggle, but we also have that longing to go back to a kind of simpler life. I mean, and this is, I guess, maybe helpful back to your question about, you know, contemporary analogs, I see this all the time in a modern meritocratic society where you have, you have kids, I have kids, and you have this constant struggle between seeing our children running like gerbils through the meritocratic wheel, trying to get to the top in that great competition, while at the same time seeing a need for, you know, returning to a kind of simplicity and friendship and order, but also a worry that maybe you can't do too much lazing around and resting because you got to get back to that So in any case, it's that kind of tension or conflict, I think, that I'm going further in thinking that, you know, this is responsible for the very motivation and creation of the abstract norms of right and of morality itself. That in some sense, morality and right are born out of a desire on the part of human beings to try to bring some harmony to that tension.
Hmm. As I was hearing you speak, I keep thinking, I don't remember if you quote this particular metaphor, but it's the second most famous wood metaphor in Kant. Everyone thinks of the crooked timber of humanity. But the other one, isn't it from the idea about the trees growing in the forest, right?
And
it takes the competition for light and resources for them to grow straight and tall.
Right.
And in many ways, that captures, you know, the benefits of the agonistic and the competitive here. But it also, I think, points to another issue here that's really prominent in the book, which is you're very conscious of setting up the idea that the end, the telos, is that of perfection rather than of a more conventional understanding of the telos of eudaimonia or what we would call happiness. And the big difference that you point to is that happiness, if one understands it in a particular way, is a state that can be achieved, a true end point. Whereas perfection, what makes it perfection, is that it is a process, an unending process. And that, I take it to be one of the advantages as you frame the term to Kant here, away from sort of Aristotelian eudaimonia. I wonder if we could go a little further, though, and you could say a little bit more about that, just because there's also a sense, as somebody that spent a lot of time reading virtue ethics literature, working on Aristotle, the idea that flourishing is a state that one can achieve and exist in is a very attractive idea. But I take it that that's one that Kant himself doesn't see as, I was about to say fulfilling, but that's an anthropological term. It's rather, it's not something that's achievable, correct? And that the benefits lie in the striving. Am I right to think that?
Yeah, I mean, in part, I think that I mean, certainly in Kant's view of both morality and politics, morality and right, he thinks that development or progress towards our moral vocation is unending, right? So there's always, you can never be a fully just human being. There's always the taint of original sin. Mm-hmm. So this might make him different than the ancients, I'm not sure, but there's always a higher state of virtue or that we can achieve. But Kant is still, I mean, he's still very much of a defender of a form of virtue ethics, and he has a view of character, that is, that we should develop our nature into more and more stable, we should develop ourselves into characters. That is, by character, what he means is we should order our desires in such a way that they're governed by a kind of moral end and purpose, and that those desires have a kind of, you know, determinate an end and form of satisfaction. So even if character can never be fully realized or perfected, we should always strive to get there. And there's a kind of political analog for that as well, which is that, you know, you're never going to get to a fully just or fully moral form of society, but you can still reconcile yourself to the condition where you find yourself, because there's always some kind of character or order that characterizes any kind of political society. Any political society is going to have some glimmer of justice that you can build on and work on. Kant is an incrementalist in this way. He's not a revolutionary thinker. So you can always work on your inner character, just like you can always work on your on the outer conditions of political society.
Yeah, this is great. Could you say a few more words about what will continue to motivate an agent to continue to make those incremental steps, especially in full knowledge that they might not ever get there with a capital T at the end with a capital E? Like, I think about this in epistemic terms a lot, right? When I teach Plato or present concepts such as zetetic skepticism, the idea to, you keep searching, even though you know that the limits of the human mind are such that we might not ever get truth with a capital T, there's still something in us that leads us to continue the fight and keep moving forward. One way of presenting and teaching Socrates, I suppose. What's the thing in us, for Kant, that keeps us moving forward incrementally?
Yeah. Yeah, this is good. I mean, this gets to the heart of his view of meaning or the meaning of life as opposed to just simply the purpose of life, which is that, so it's not a zetetic view where it's, you might think of as a zetetic view as just kind of circling around the same sorts of questions, but rather Kant's view, of course, is a progressive view. And so that human beings, humanity as a whole strives towards moral and political perfection. So I myself am obliged to locate myself in the story of humanity's progress towards its moral and political perfection. And I'm motivated to sort of inch humanity, if I could just, move humanity forward one little step, I'm motivated in that because that effort in part has meaning. It's part of this grand development of humanity's overall progress that lends our existence meaning as such, that our existence gains this meaning only in virtue of the fact that we're on the way towards something better, that we can lead towards a better world. This is why Kant is so fearful in some of his history essays about views of history where things will lead to catastrophe, or things will always get worse, or things are just, humanity is such that it's always just cyclical. No amount of effort that we can engage in, it'll all end up leading to naught. And you can see kind of contemporary analogs of this. There are a lot of doomsayers that are out there who, verge on a kind of despair about human progress. And, for Kant, that's the route towards eliminating the kind of motivation that you're talking about. That it's precisely the positing of a kind of common moral and political end on the part of humanity that precisely does motivate each agent to make one small step in the direction of that progress. And it does hurt our motivation when it looks like things are moving back, right? So in 2016, when Trump gets elected, a lot of people thought we were taking a step back, and that harms our motivation. But so the hope towards that higher end is what motivates.
Yeah. This is great. Now, you mentioned the fact that we have kids. I think of, I'm not going to say too much about family life here, but just about the sort of students we teach. One of the things that you're saying, and I think this is very compelling, this idea that Kant believes, that we need to believe, that we're moving the ball down the field a little bit, and through our humble efforts that we're participating in something much greater than ourselves, and advancing the progress of humanity. And that's very compelling to me in many ways. It also speaks to Kant's profound optimism, and I wonder if that's a word that you would share. But what I'm really interested in, given what you just said, is what that might mean for real living agents today, and especially our students. I don't think that I'm unique in saying that one of the things that our students in some of their cynicism feel is a great deal of hopelessness and a lack of agency. And I think that the classic issue is climate change and the feeling that it's a fait accompli and that this is a terrible thing that no amount of individual effort will ever change, and it's happening and there's nothing we can do. I don't know that we can address all of the sort of student anxiety that kids are feeling today simply to the issue of climate change. Of course, we live in a complex world. There's a lot of things out there. But that's one example of where there's a deep feeling of hopelessness. And so can Kant speak to that? Or maybe put differently, are there things that we can do in our, perhaps in our individual lives, in our capacities as teachers, but more importantly, in our capacities as citizens and those engaged in the modern polity, are there things that we can do to advance Kant's vision in the face of what seems to be something that is a real challenge for that vision, which is that deep sense of hopelessness, or what sometimes in the book you refer to as anomie?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think there are some things that Kant can offer in terms of, you could say, sort of changes in elite behavior, and you might think in terms of kind of changes to our institutions. Because I think both of these are sources of kind of modern contemporary hopelessness, right? And I mean, the fact that our elites tend to claim that things are hopeless, or tend to precisely get in the way or obstruct progress, or seem to be thoroughly cynical and power grabbing, that it seems like any amount of effort in the direction of political change will be difficult to achieve, right? So I haven't looked at the latest polls, but it seems, you know, that Congress's approval rating, or, you know, trust in Congress is, you know, continues to plummet below cockroaches. So in any case, I mean, this is obviously a difficult thing for any elite to accomplish, but I mean, some of the things that Kant develops in terms of, you know, norms of honor, norms of politeness, not to mention, I mean, if you don't even have to go so far as the moral project, but sort of norms of civilization, if internalized by elites, can provide a kind of, you know, more of a sense of a kind of common purpose and a sense of hope and achievement on the part of a kind of common society, as opposed to dividing society in a kind of continued competitive struggle. So I say that in terms of elites. I mean, in terms of institutions, you know, Kant is not, you know, there are other figures, I think, in the liberal tradition to look for maybe more sophisticated account of the kinds of developments and of the institutions that may kind of solve your problem. I think of people like Tocqueville. But even Kant himself, I think, in the development of some of the institutions that he talks about, in, for example, his late work on the conflict of the faculties, where he's discussing the organization, say, of universities, and how universities can themselves be organized in such a way that connect more directly toward to overall social and political ends. So the kind of organization of institutions in such a way that makes clear how institutions themselves are connected to common purposes and have lodged within them kind of discrete or distinct ends that satisfy different parts of our kind of common longings. I think, you know, establishing institutions in those sorts of ways, I think, can go a long way to sort of, because I think this is in part why our students have a kind of sense of hopelessness, because the institutions that they belong to are themselves kind of adrift, right? And don't have a kind of connection to the kind of common purposes. So insofar as institutions can do that, they can sort of activate that sense of agency a lot better.
Yeah, I'm often reminded of the fact that our students, you've come back to 2016 and Trump several times, and indeed, and the book on acknowledging that. And you know, one can understand why one feels hopeless if your entire political conscience was forged, if you came of political age at a time of such tremendous tumult, and a time when whatever one thinks of the value of the norms, these are norms that are breaking down, and it can't but create a sense of chaos. And I think you're right to point to Kant as an antidote to some of this, not least of which because I use the term optimist, but there's something undeniably inspiring in reading Kant. I mean, not just the Wasis Aufklärung essay, and I think our students tend to feel it when they do that, but even, when one thinks of the starry heavens and the moral law, what's above and what's within us, I think students are often genuinely moved at the prospect of, to put it in just the general technical term, Kant's transcendentalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, a group of our students who often, you know, take a trip abroad and do, you know, engage in kind of various humanitarian efforts. And, you know, why do these students do that? I mean, there's, you know, clearly Kant is tapping into something true and right about human longings, that we have a desire to make the world a little bit better. I mean, in our short time on this planet, and not simply while it away in forms of entertainment and distraction, right? At the end of the day, when we come to the end of our existence and look back on it, and Kant does this exercise, and he thinks about, you know, the end of life, and when you look back on it, you know, a life that you look back on it and it's filled with nothing but distraction, he says, is a very short life. You look back on it because there was nothing much that actually happened. You were a passive observer to your life. Things happened to you. You know, pleasures went through you. Whereas the active person is the person that lots of things happen to. It's an exciting life because you engage in a kind of, you have various series of agency that you undertake actions. Your freedom becomes manifest in the world. And it's exciting and interesting. And so, I mean, insofar as we can get our students to recognize that agency and freedom actually is a, you know, it's ennobling of our existence, and it can be deeply satisfying in that sort of way, I think it can help.
Yeah, that's great. That's beautifully put. And it also occurs to me that, I mean, we've used the word anthropology a lot in the discussion, and one of the services of the book is, again, to connect these anthropological lectures to the critical writings. And that's more than just sort of inside baseball within the Kant world and taking a few steps beyond Loudon and Frierson and Zamido. But also, you know, one of the things that you open up very nicely is the ways in which Kant simply gets the phenomena right in terms of our existence as creatures with multiple mixed motives, that mm-hmm. there are noble desires within us to advance the good of others. But there's undeniably also, and you trace this out very nicely, desires for not just esteem and recognition, but for honor and glory. There's self-interested desires to satisfy certain material comforts. All these sorts of things are undeniably part of us. And I think that, you know, the desiccated Kant that we get just from reading the groundwork doesn't address those. But this does, and this does in ways that I think bring Kant into, not just make him a more interesting figure, but put him into real conversation with other figures in the liberal tradition.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, thank you for saying that. I mean, it's in part has a, what you're saying has a political analog in the way I'm developing it too. Because, in addition to the sort of desiccated account of human nature that you tend to get about Kant as, you know, this is a sort of rational agency, metaphysical mm-hmm. view of the person and so forth. You also get a desiccated view of politics as a, you know, in Rawls, for example. I mean, it's sort of great neo-Kantian in this way that, you know, Rawls thinks the great exemplification of public reason is the Supreme Court, right? Mm. That the Supreme Court is the sort of paragon of public reason in politics. And that's the height of politics there for Rawls. I think for Kant has a much more expansive, I mean, the Supreme Court obviously would be important for Kant. It's important in interpreting the law, but there's also a much more expansive understanding of the role of politics precisely to encompass and try to govern the kinds of conflicts that you're talking about that occur in the human soul. And it requires then an analysis of the different parts of society that emerge from those different parts of our soul, again, the culture, civilization, and political community that I mentioned before, and those orders themselves then kind of come into a sort of conflict with one another. The best, I think, exemplification of this are the sort of, you know, the traditional order, the sort of constant tension that we see in societies between tradition and progress, sort of traditional orders of religion, for example, religious institutions with institutions of progress that always rub up against one another and in Kant's view necessarily do, and this is not something to bemoan or overcome, but something to that sort of motivates and makes politics possible.
Lovely. I was going to ask a number of questions about the Kant scholarship, but it almost seems that that move would lead us down from the high heights that you've brought us to. I wonder if on that note that might be an appropriate place to conclude the conversation. Any final thoughts about? I wonder. I'm new at this job. You're the pro here, so I'm almost tempted to ask: are there any questions that I should have asked you that you wish that I had that you could have talked about?
No, I think we covered the book really well. Must say, this is your first time at it, Ryan. It does not seem like it at all.
Okay. Don't worry. I'm not coming for your job. I think I'm one and done here. So.
Well, thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it's been a joy, and I really appreciate this project as a whole. I think that you're doing something very important here. I mean, and I really should say, having tried to contribute a little bit to the Kant scholarship, I understand what went into this. You know, as philosophers that are on the job market have their own area of specialization simply in Kant, and that's because it takes a tremendous amount of time to read and work through that literature and cut new edges. But the fact that you've done that with regard to the Rousseau reception questions that people like Velkley and Shelv worked on, the anthropology questions that we already alluded to, the question of his deontology versus teleology and building on Geyer and Wood, all of these are real accomplishments. But the fact that you've done that without losing sight of what's genuinely politically important and why this particular turn is necessary at our current moment in the crisis of liberalism, being able to balance fine-grained attention to text and to the scholarship with these larger political questions is really quite a thing to accomplish in the covers of a single book. So many kudos to you.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that. And I will say this is something that motivates me to the study of the history of political thought is, writing a book like this where I engage with a lot of the great literature out there, and there's a lot of great literature on Kant that I learned a lot and can actually benefit from. I mean, when there's often there's a phrase about, mountains of scholarship, or there's mountains of scholarship. In some ways, it might be intimidating, but also, there's a way in which you can climb up that mountain and see a little bit farther, right? So there's something benefit to that. But in any case, doing the history of political thought where you can engage with a great thinker, but also bringing to bear a great thinker on some important contemporary issues. I mean, this is why I got into this job in the first place, and happy to write a book like this. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the book and for this wonderful opportunity. It's really been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.